welcome to Turn the Page, the official podcast of the Syosset Public Library.
Welcome to today's edition of Turn the Page podcast. I am one of your librarian hosts, Stacey Mencher, and with me is
Barney Leventino, another librarian here at Syosset Library.
And we are very honored today to have our guest author be, and please introduce yourself.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jeffrey Archer, and I'm delighted to be on the show. I'm a huge fan of libraries and librarians, so it's a special occasion for me.
Oh, we're huge fans of writers, so it's a mutual affection here.
So I came across your website. We have a lot of patrons who love your writing. You're a very popular author here. And we were looking up the series of your books because they wanted to know if you were coming out with anything. And I saw that you have your own podcast. And I was like, this is awesome. He likes to interact with people. Let's see if we could get him on. And now here you are. So thank you for joining us.
My great pleasure. I do like talking to people who read books because one learns a lot from what they have to say and what they feel, particularly when you're as old as I am. You like to hear what young people have to say.
Stacey's closer to the young person demographic than I am.
But everyone's young at heart. You're only as old as you feel.
We came across the book. It's a William Warwick book, Over My Dead Body, which is coming out in paperback next month. And I believe in the pipeline is another William Warwick work, which will be released in September. Is that correct?
That is correct. Absolutely. He will have advanced from a chief inspector in the Metropolitan Police. And he, in the next book, will be a superintendent. In the book, Over My Dead Body, of course, that's about four unsolved murders when he's in the murder squad. But in the next book that's coming out in September, he has been transferred to royal protection. And among the people he has to protect is Princess Diana.
That's exciting. I know a lot of our patrons are going to look forward to that. So many of our patrons love Princess Diana and reading about her and everything, and they also like thrillers, so perfect.
Well, I had the privilege of working with her over a long period of time because my hobby then and still is as an auctioneer, as a charity auctioneer. And so that is how we came into contact with each other, and so I was able to see her at close quarters over many years.
I talked to a lot of writers about their writing process and how they go about producing their work. And some of them tell me that they have the story really plotted out from A to Z in their head, and the actual writing process becomes almost a matter of, you know, filling in the blanks with characters and dialogue. Others tell me that they sit down in front of the keyboard and begin writing, and the story just kind of flows on its own. I think both are probably exaggerations in terms of what the process really is. What about for you? How do you go about beginning a work, or how? What's the process for you?
Well, I'm in the latter category. I rarely know more than three pages ahead. If I'm lucky, I know three pages ahead. And even when I come back after the first draft, it's a danger at one point, because if you were to set everything out, I'm frightened of that, because I've always worried that if I know where I'm going, the reader will know where I'm going. And so I've always thought, if I don't know, how can they know? And the only other difference, which of course I understand in your position as a couple of professionals, that you're too young, both of you, to understand that I hand write every word. You said, Barney, and they then start tapping, or they then start, I don't. I can switch on a light, which is about the extreme I am in modern electronics. I hand write every word with a felt tip pen. and I do 14 drafts, sometimes more, with a felt tip pen. And so you may say, I heard you say, and I listened carefully to those words, Barney. You wonder if they're exaggerating. No, I handwrite 14 drafts and I do not know where I'm going, about three pages ahead, if I'm lucky. Now, I might know in the sense that with Cain and Abel, I knew it was the story of two men born on the same day, one with everything, one with nothing. They would only meet once, but it would change their whole lives. But then you've got to begin once upon a time.
That is definitely a different approach than what I've discussed with other writers. You're the first who's told me that he's done it by hand with a felt tip pen. And you could really go old school and go with a quill and an ink.
Yeah, that's impressive. But how long does it typically take you to write a book? And does it change depending on which book you're writing, or does it average out?
Well, I'm sure I want to hear Barney's tell us what other authors do, and he doesn't believe them. But I never answer that question in the orthodox manner. I begin work at 5:30 in the morning. I get up at 5:30, begin work at 6. I go from 6 to 8, from 10 to 12, from 2 to 4, to 6 to 8, light supper, in bed by 9:30, 10. First draft, 50 days. Second draft, 30 days. Third draft, 20 days. So the answer to your question, Stacey, is 1,000 hours. Now, putting it in simple terms, over a period of a year. Now, stick with that, Barney, because that's what I do.
I got it.
That's really impressive, because when we've spoken to authors, whether it's been for our podcast or they come to virtually visit the library, because with the pandemic, it's been very easy to reach out to authors to have them come virtually visit on Zoom. Well, they'll talk about the writing process, whether they just fly, but like what Barney asked of what's your writing style, how to go into the book. It's interesting to see how people talk about like their day-to-day writing, which you just brought up of your schedule, of the blocks that you do.
The pandemic didn't make a great deal of difference in the sense that when I'm away writing, when my head is down, you could have a world war on, I'd hardly notice. But I did get more done, because what I missed dreadfully was I wasn't able to go to the theatre, which I do twice a week at least. I'm going tonight to see a Trump play in London at the Old Vic. So I go twice a week to the theatre. I wasn't able to interact with friends, which was something I missed dreadfully, because they all come up with stories and ideas the whole time. And I was suddenly aware I wasn't getting that. And I was missing my sport. So all in all, the difference for me, Stacey, was that I was actually getting more work done, because I wasn't taking those breaks in between. I hardly stopped writing.
Did going through the pandemic affect not necessarily your process, but the content? Did your storylines change at all based upon or as a consequence of what was happening around the world?
I don't think so, because then I was on the fourth William Warwick, and he was into drugs. And I'd done the research, and I'd seen the head of the drug squad at the Metropolitan Police. I'd taken him through questions on drugs, so because I wanted to know about cocaine, crack cocaine, heroin, marijuana. I wanted the details in Britain and how they were affected. So I'd done all that, Barney. So when I sat down, I was able to write the whole book and then start research. Now, of course, research doesn't require a lot of going to libraries nowadays. I'm very aware when I was a child that you relied on encyclopedias. You relied to look things up. Encyclopedia Britannica, one of the most famous in the world, a great American production, is on my shelves, and it's looking it's covered in dust, because you can press a button nowadays and say, who was president of the United States in 1932? And up will come all the facts immediately. You don't have to rush and look up presidents of the United States, the year, the page. It comes up immediately. We live in a new world in that sense. What I did think might, and you two have a greater knowledge of this than me, what I did think might happen was, because of the pandemic, a lot of new authors would arrive. And I suspected that a lot of people who'd said to me over the years, well, you know, Geoffrey, I haven't got the time to write a book. I'm so busy. Well, they didn't have that excuse any longer, did they?
It's true.
I asked the question, and you, your comments bring something else to mind, but I'll come back to it. And I asked the question because I was speaking to a writer about a year ago, I guess, and he said that really pretty much midstream, he changed the whole scope of his book based upon the reality that he was looking at every day and seeing what was going on in the world. Yeah. And I've spoken to a couple of writers who have said, maybe not to that extent, but their stories changed a little bit
Barney, you have to remember that the William Warwicks start in the 80s and go into the 90s.
No, I understand that.
Lucky enough to get him up to commissioner of the Metro, if I live long enough, I'm 82 years old. If I live long enough and can get him up to commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, which will be four more books, yes, it'll be up to date. But I will have an advantage over the people you've just spoken about, Barney, because I've lived through COVID, now living through what's happening in Ukraine. I will be able to blend that in much more naturally, because history will have moved on again by the time I get to that.
You know, you mentioned something else, and I said I was going to circle back to it in the course of your commenting on the way technology has changed the nature of the research that you might have to do, how you can push the button and you don't need to take the dusty encyclopedia off the shelf. I'm of an age, and I think I have a few years on Stacy on this, but I remember doing research for my high school and college papers, and I remember pulling out the encyclopedia, and I remember going to look for one particular item, and in the course of that endeavor, my eye would be caught by an article on something completely unrelated.
Yes.
And I would absorb material that I never would have otherwise touched upon. And that, we lose a little bit of that. In fact, we lose a lot of that with this, okay, this is exactly what I'm looking for, hit enter, there it is. You lose the extraneous that really forms an underlayment in your mind of topics that you may not know precisely about, but you know enough to at least, it rings a bell and it kind of pushes you in a different direction. And I see it all the time here. I see kids doing
research.
That's
a good thing. I was reading a book this morning given to me by a friend for which he'd paid $1 in a sale because he's that sort of man, but he thought I would like it and he was right. And it was the story of the great art sales, because I'm on art mad. You will know in my books that art plays a very large part. But he gave me a 1952 book about great sales. And I found a sentence this morning, Barney, which would never, if I hadn't read this book, would never have got in. So in the latest book, a man buys a piece of property in London in 1942. And he gets it at a very silly price because we're in the middle of the Second World War. And that is what I have written. And that explains why he got it at a very silly price and why in the 1990s, touching the year 2000, it's worth several million. But I read in this book this morning, Barney, and when I get back to the next draft, it will be slipped in, and it has to be slipped in. You mustn't say, hey, I found this wonderful, how clever I am. Watch, I'm going to put it in. You have to slip it in so the reader doesn't even notice. So having just told you that story, I discovered this morning that Christie's, the great auctioneering house, was bombed to the ground in 1941. I didn't know that, Barney.
Wow.
And so the I will add to the sentence, he purchased it in 1942 for a ridiculous, an art gallery, for a ridiculous sum of money, but then the seller may well have been influenced by the fact that Christie's had been bombed to the ground in 1941. So you're quite right, Barney. You've got to have more than just the one fact given to you. So I do a lot of reading is the answer to that question, particularly in the fields I'm fascinated by, like I'm fascinated by art, I'm fascinated by politics. I had the great honor of working for Margaret Thatcher for 11 years and John Major for 7 years as in different capacities. And so those are the things that get into my book, but you're so right, Barney. If you stop reading, you will not have the width, the depth to entertain the reader.
That's really fascinating to me that you will pull something that you might have just read to help influence and influence like naturally in the story rather than just like, oh, here's like a fact. Let me throw it at you like some authors do.
Yes. You have to be careful. You have to be careful of that. You have to be careful of that. The chairman of the Confederation of British Industries and I had lunch yesterday. This is what the point I'm making that Barney made earlier, that I wasn't able to mix with people. I had a lunch yesterday with the chairman of the CBI. And he said to me, he was talking about luck at our age. I'm older than he is. I was sharing about how much is involved in luck. And he said, you must remember Seneca said that luck was the coming together of preparation and opportunity. Well, that's a wonderful line. Now, going back to your point, Stacey, yes, I want to put that into a book, but it mustn't come with arrows and squares and circles. It must drop in so the reader enjoys it, but almost doesn't notice you've done it.
Well, that's the craft of writing, where it seems like a simple process, and it seems to the reader a natural sentence in a logical place. But the art and the craft of knowing how and where and when to place it is really what separates a good writer from a not so good writer. I'll put you in the good writer category.
What separates a good writer from a great one, Barney? Tell me that.
Well, I didn't want to inflate the ego too much.
There. I mean, 275 million copies, 7 number ones on the New York Times. What do you want?
There you go. You touched a little bit earlier on your political career, and by anybody's definition of or anybody's standard, you have lived and are living a really fascinating life. You've done and been and seen things that are just, you know, the everyday person doesn't have those experiences. And coming back to all of that, and then your career as a writer, did you always aspire to writing, or did that become kind of something that just flowed out later on in life?
Good question. I think I am reminded of Proust's words, we all end up doing the thing we're second best at. I began life wanting to captain the England cricket team, which would be the equivalent of captaining the New York baseball team. But I sadly, I don't have an eye, Barney. So if you throw a ball at me, I'm afraid I can't knock it out of the ground. So that had to be given up very quickly. I then wanted to be prime minister, and that didn't happen. So writing came certainly as by mistake. But you see, I don't think I'm a writer, Barney. I think I'm a storyteller. And I think that's a God-given gift. Writers are highly educated people. They're well-read. And they can write, and you get great historians, you great mathematicians, whatever they write about. But telling a story is a totally different thing altogether. What you've got to work at is if you can do the storytelling because it is a God-given gift, you then have to improve your writing the whole time so that you're attempting to do both. because that's the combination that defines a truly, to use my word, but you didn't, defines the word great. And you will see it in Stefan Zweig, who is, of course, a genius. You will see it in Dickens, who's a genius. You will see it in Jane Austen, who's a genius. They combine the two. They combine the writing and the storytelling. But I don't give a damn how well educated you are. You cannot pop down to Bloomingdale's and get a packet of storytelling.
Very true. So do you have any advice for anybody that wants to be a great writer, great storyteller?
Well, a lot of young people come to see me and talk about it. And I say to them, Stacey, go to the ballet. And they look at me very strangely and say, you want me to go? I say, go to the ballet. And they say, why, Geoffrey, should I go to the ballet? I say, if you sit and watch a great ballerina, you see a prima ballerina, see how many hours she has done to be up there on front of the stage. Then look at the dancers behind and see how many hours they've done just to be on the stage as a dancer. And then think about the thousands of young women who wanted to be on the stage as a dancer. Why should it be any different if you want to be number one on the New York Times bestsellers list? It takes just as many hours and just as much talent. So don't go into it thinking, well, as a young Irishman once said to me when I was addressing Trinity College Dublin, a young Irishman said, you've ruined my weekend, Geoffrey. And I said, I beg your pardon. He said, you've ruined my weekend. I was hoping to write the great Irish novel this weekend. If it was that easy, there'd be no ballerinas.
Good advice. I like that. Because we often partner with writing groups to help either give space for people to write or help find the tools, whether it's a book on writing or author's advice or something.
You can't do a book on writing, and you certainly can't do a book on storytelling. It's in one line. You can either tell a story or you can't. Good night.
That's in the DNA.
Yeah.
I mean, if you look at the great storytellers of history, and I could name you, in my view, the top 10, often their first novels are masterpieces. In other words, they were great storytellers the day they started. They may not have been great writers, but they were great storytellers the day they started. I don't have to remind you that To Kill a Mockingbird was her first book. Doesn't that tell you all you need to know about storytelling?
Yeah.
Who do you read nowadays?
Do you mean by that, Barney, of modern writers, or who do I admire?
Well, let's take both. Who writing today do you find of interest?
Well, I've just read a New York writer who you will know, and has become very popular in this country now, who's written a book, A Gentleman in Moscow, which I thought was quite outstanding. That was my book of the year last year. And I had the privilege of meeting him, with the Duchess of Cornwall, who invited us both to a function at St. James's Palace. So I had the privilege of meeting him as well. So that was the best book I've read in the last couple of years. I enjoyed immensely The Tattooist of Auschwitz. I found it interesting that she had found someone who was still alive and had actually had a job, a Jewish man who'd had a job at Auschwitz and survived, Heather Morris, and I enjoyed that. My hero is Stefan Zweig, who, of course, escaped from the Nazis to go and live in New York. And at one point in his career, when he was in his early 50s, was the most successful writer on earth and is now virtually unknown. But the Pushkin Press have brought him back, and Beware of Pity, which I consider to be a masterpiece, is now once again being read by a lot of people. So those are the two. And it's so sort of cliche to say, well, I love Dickens, I love Jane Austen, I love Dumas. Of course I do. And going back, of course they do. They're great storytellers and great writers. And going back to Stacey's point, I would remind you, Stacey, at your young age, when you've still got the world ahead of you, if I may dare say so, that Dumas wrote The Count of Monte Cristo and The Three Musketeers in the same year.
I didn't know that.
Wow.
Pages for 1 year.
Quite right, Bonnie. Quite right.
I don't know if this is a fair question or not. And if you want to stay out of it, that's fine. But you're over in Europe. You're on the other side of the Atlantic from us, and you're pretty well plugged into the things over there. And what's the overall mood right now with regard to everything going on in Ukraine? I mean, is there a real fear of this thing escalating beyond where it is now? Because I know here we're talking about it, and it's a scary situation.
Well, I hope they are. You're the most important nation on earth. I hope to God you are talking about it. But I would say to Stacey, rather than you, poor old thing, Barney, I would say to Stacey that a young Bulgarian who works for me, a very charming, very capable woman, has just gone back to Bulgaria. And she said something, Barney, that I think would fascinate you. She's 24 years old, bright, attractive, intelligent woman. And she looked at a picture of Mary and myself in the days when we were both at Oxford. My wife, Mary, and I were at Oxford. My wife is currently the chairman of the Science Museum in Great Britain, and the Queen has made her a dame. So I'm married to a very remarkable woman. But when she looked at the picture and saw us when we were 24, 23, she said, oh, how lucky you were. And I thought, Barney, she was going to say, because wonderful to be at Oxford and to be that young and to be in love, I thought all that was going to come out. No, she didn't say that, Stacey. So listen carefully. She said, how lucky you were to be born in an era with no world wars. Because I was born in 1940 and therefore never saw, I only heard about it. I'm now 82. COVID came when I was 80. The problems with Putin and Ukraine have come when I'm 82. So I had that amazing period between 1940 and 2020 without a world war. And so for your generation, Stacey, and for anyone of your age listening to this podcast, it could be a very different world, to answer Barney's question. It could be a very different world in the next 10 years. And Barney, because I was in politics, sat in the House of Commons for 5 years, currently sitting in the House of Lords, where I've been for 25 years, I have a day-to-day interest in what's happening. I'm fascinated by it. And I am worried, because Putin is not only an evil man and a really awful evil man, but I remember at the end of Margaret Thatcher's reign, she'd done 11 and a half years. And I remember thinking at 10, you can do another 10. I was wrong. The president of the United States is right. 8 years is enough for any president of the United States or for any leader. People forget that Putin's been in charge for 20 years. He's so out of touch. And the people around him are so frightened of him. Don't be surprised if he presses a button we are all frightened of.
Oh, boy. Okay. On a lighter note, let's talk a little bit more.
You asked the question, Barney.
I know I did. I know I did. And it reinforced what I felt and what I know. And I look at my my now 1 year and 1 week old grandson with a little baby sister on the way. And I think exactly what you think. And it's a frightening time.
Yeah.
And hope we get past it and get through
it. So you've got one daughter and one on the way.
No, this is my grandson. Oh. And my grandson has a little baby sister on the way. This is my older son.
I've got five grandchildren and they are the joy of my life. But I do worry.
I'm learning that.
I do worry for them.
So let's get back to William Wallen and talk about, you know, where he came from, where he's going, and let's talk about the newest book and as much as you can tell us about it beyond what you've
already seen. Where's he going? He started as in Nothing Ventured, as you know, but one as a constable on the beat in London. And I had always planned, partly because of my age and realized that sort of finally woke up because I'm fairly dumb, that I wasn't going to live forever. But I started him off as a constable on the beat. And I decided he was going to be a constable, and then he would be a sergeant, then he would be a detective inspector, then he'd be a chief inspector, then he'd be a superintendent, then he'd be chief superintendent, then he'd be commander, then he'd be commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. 8 books. But I also decided every book would have a different subject. So the first one was art fraud, the second one was drugs, the third one was police corruption, and the fourth one, over my dead body, he's been moved on to the murder squad. So in answer to your question, Barney, book 5, which I'm writing at the moment, is royal protection. And in order to confirm what you puzzled me over before, I've got a blue clue what book 6, 7, or 8 are, because I don't think that way. I do the book I'm doing, put it on one side, and pray. And still pray, still wonder if anyone will buy it, still wonder if I've got it right. That's part of the fun and part of the deal. And so if I can finish all 8, Barney, he will be the commissioner of the Metropolitan Police. And I have currently at the moment the great privilege of my 2 chief researchers are a chief superintendent, John Sutherland, who retired from the Metropolitan Police. He broke down, he had a mental breakdown from one murder too many, to use his words. And a detective sergeant in the drug squad, also retired after 25 years in the drug squad. So my background and my historic facts or police facts are checked by them meticulously. And so I've been able, and each time I say, well, it's drugs this time, they get me the head of the drug squad. Or I say it's murder this time, they get me the head of the murder squad. So I am lucky and privileged to be talking to people who've done 30, 25, 30 years in the Metropolitan Police and can bring stories to you the whole time. You've only got to sit and listen to them. Out they pour, these stories, and I hope they pour into my book. Of course they don't all. Some of them are very boring. Some of them are part of their daily life, but some of them, and they often get wrong which it is. Sometimes they'll give you a little gem that they think is boring, and I realize my readers will absolutely love. I'll give you an example. We had a situation where I was teasing the chief superintendent and said, well, you were a public school boy and your sister is a professor at Oxford. You must have been teased when you were in the police force about being so well educated. He said, well, as long as you work hard, Geoffrey, they don't notice. But I was one day. I was a young constable. This is in book one. I arrived at the station and they said, there's been a problem. One of the men in the cell has collapsed. We have to get this immediately. And he handed me a prescription. Rush down to Boots and get this immediately. And he said, I ran all the way to Boots. There was a queue at the prescription. And I said, I apologize. I was in uniform. I apologize. I have to have this immediate. Went straight to the lady on the counter and the lady read it. And she said, I need this immediate. He said, I need this immediate. She turned around and handed him a packet of condoms. She handed him back the piece of paper. And on it, it said, I'm a young constable and I've met this super girl. And I think maybe it's my chance at last. And he gave that as an example. And I said, that's wonderful because it's so human. It's so real. But again, going back to your part, Barney, you can't just say, hey, I got a good idea here. I want you to know about it. It has to slip into the daily life of a constable so that you get the story and you laugh and you move on and the plot moves on as well. And between them all, I've met, I suppose, 10 very senior officers now. And one of them was pathetic, the head of the drug squad. He was pathetic, he had no stories at all. He could tell me how many people took crack cocaine, how many people took heroin, how many people took marijuana? I said, you're useless. I love you, but you're useless. Tell me something. Did you ever get annoyed? He said, oh, yes, he said. When I was in the burglary squad, he said, there was one man I was chasing for a long time. He knew I was after him. I knew he knew I was after him. But what really annoyed me, Jeffrey, was he used to send me every Christmas, he'd send me a Harrods hamper. And I said, that is a story. That, yeah. And I now say to anyone, when I'm talking to any of my policemen, I say, give me a Harrods hamper. Because I know that they know I don't want just the facts. I want anecdotes, because that's what the readers love. And you see, when they read that story, I said to him, listen, idiot, I said, having waited 2 years for this bloody piece of it. And he got the first 10 pages of the new book, because they're all sitting around the desk and they've got this Harrods hamper in the middle of the table, and they're not allowed to take anything out of it. They have to give it to the charity department in the basement at Scotland Yard. But it's a wonderful opening, because you can get all your characters around a table and this ridiculous situation of them having been sent a Harrods hamper. So the answer to your question is anecdotal is every bit as important as just straight facts.
This has been absolutely fascinating, spending time with you.
I've been loving Liz.
You made a comment before about you're still praying, you're hoping that people buy it and that you're getting it right. I will tell you that you're still getting it right, and the New York Times lists tell us that people are still buying them. It really has been absolutely wonderful talking to you. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm looking forward to the next one in September. And
thank you.
Looking forward to whatever else is coming down the pike with you.
We have several fans of yours at the library, whether it's a staff member or a patron. They're like, oh, this is coming out, like telling a coworker who does like our editing. She's just like, oh, that's so exciting. Like, you got Jeffrey Archer to agree. And I was like, yeah, we reached out. Like, so thank you so much for
libraries. Libraries have been for me over the years. People say, well, of course, you get nothing, Jeffrey. I say, yes, you do. You get readers, and readers talk, and readers read again. And they're not always able to go to libraries. Don't be silly, I said. Libraries are wonderful. Long live libraries.
Well,
thank you so, so much. It really has been a pleasure.
Yes, we will close this chapter of Turn the Page. Thank you for listening, and stay tuned for another episode.